I don't take my freedom of speech, and I have speech, total freedom of speech, but I can't take it for granted anymore.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us. And I want to give Lena Muntzer, just we have 30 seconds, but the last word on what you expect to happen from here as you watch what has happened to your country, at least for this moment, from afar.
Look, we're very terrified of the day after. Mr. Levy talked about the effect on internal Israeli politics. We're also very afraid. Lebanon is a very fragile, you know, pluralist state. But at the same time, the Israelis also have known very much how to work on that. So they've been specifically bombing where the refugees have gathered. We've seen over the last few months that people have been turning away refugees. These refugees are largely Shia from South Lebanon and from the southern suburbs of Beirut. So there's been a lot of hostility that has incurred. So we're really, really afraid of the day after in terms of, you know, the internal stability of the country and what's going to happen to it. And I just want to say, you know, to go back to this idea of collateral damage, this is something that the United States normalized, you know, in our region, in Iraq, the way to punish an entire country in order to change some sort of internal mechanism, which then devastates the country because, of course, they have no idea what they're doing. And this is not how you bring about change. So we're all also very afraid of now what's going to happen to Lebanon internally as we go on. And as the pieces are picked up and a lot of anger and recrimination is going to start coming to the surface among the population. So, you know, as we say in Arabic, Allah yustur, like we have no idea what's going to happen.
Lena Muntzer, we want to thank you for being with us, Lebanese writer and senior editor of the arts and literature magazine, The Markaz, and Gideon Levy, award-winning Israeli journalist at Haaretz, author of the new book, The Killing of Gaza, Reports on a Catastrophe. We thank you so much both for joining us from Montreal and from Tel Aviv. Coming up, we speak to ACLU attorney Chase Strangio next week. He will become the first openly trans attorney to argue a case before the U.S. Supreme Court. Stay with us.
It's been too long trying to get along, giving you what you want. Now I know without a doubt who I am. Can I be true to you?
To be like, I won't let nobody tell me how to. There are many roads, there are many ways. I won't let nobody tell me. I won't let nobody tell me how to be like.
By Clarity featuring Claro. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. When incoming Republican President Donald Trump returns to office, he's vowed to target the LGBTQIA community. Our next guest will be a key figure in challenging this. Next week, Chase Strangio will make history as the first openly transgender lawyer to make oral arguments before the Supreme Court as the justices consider Tennessee's ban on gender-affirming hormone therapies for transgender minors. The case argues the ban is a form of sex discrimination. Last week, the Republican House Speaker, Mike Johnson, announced a policy banning transgender people from using some Capitol restrooms that correspond to their gender. This came after Republican Congressmember Nancy Mace introduced a resolution to ban transgender women from using women's restrooms at the Capitol, then posted about it more than 300 times in just a matter of a few days on social media. This follows the election of Delaware Democrat Sarah McBride as the first openly transgender Congress member. McBride dismissed the Capitol bathroom bans as a distraction during a recent interview on CBS.
Some members of the small Republican conference majority decided to get headlines and to manufacture a crisis.
Chase Strangio joins us now, co-director of the American Civil Liberties Union's LGBTQ and HIV Project. In a week, again, he becomes the first openly transgender lawyer to argue a case before the Supreme Court. Looking at Tennessee, welcome to Democracy Now! There's a lot to discuss here. Why don't we begin with this case in which you're going to make history?
Well, good to see you, Amy. Thank you for having me. We are before the Supreme Court at this moment when transgender people are under so much scrutiny. And this comes on the tail of 24 states banning evidence-based medicine for transgender adolescents. And that is why we are before the Supreme Court now. One of those states is Tennessee. Tennessee has categorically banned medical treatment for adolescents only when that treatment is prescribed in a manner that Tennessee considers inconsistent with a person's sex. So what we're arguing before the Supreme Court is that, look, this is a simple example of sex discrimination. Our clients, so if you take, for example, a transgender adolescent boy, he cannot receive testosterone to live consistent with his male identity because he was assigned female at birth. Had he been assigned male at birth, he could receive that same medication for that same purpose. That is sex discrimination, and Tennessee has to justify it, which the district court concluded that Tennessee just simply did not. The courts across the country that have actually looked at the evidence have repeatedly found that the claims about the harms of this treatment just do not hold up to even the slightest bit of scrutiny. But of course, we lost in the appellate court. We're now before the Supreme Court making the case that this is just a plain and simple example of sex discrimination. And the fact that it's sex discrimination against trans people doesn't make it any less unconstitutional.
And Chase, this comes in the in a period when the Republican Party used anti-trans ads throughout the presidential campaign. I'm wondering your reaction to the impact of those ads around the country.
Yeah, it is astonishing to think about $250 million that have been spent focused on a group that represents less than 1% of the population. I think it comes out to, you know, almost $100 to $200 per trans person in the United States. And obviously, there's sort of two fundamental things that happen as a result of those ads. The first is just the impact on trans people ourselves. We are living in a climate in which we are being demonized, in which we are being blamed for structural failures of this country. I talk about scapegoating if you're blaming trans people for everything from, you know, changes in education to school shootings, to changing gender norms across the board. So that's one aspect of this. And then the other is that this rhetoric, and I will say the post-election legitimizing of it by Democrats, is what creates the policy realities that we're living under. The policy realities where you have 550 anti-trans bills introduced in a single year, resulting in the stripping away of healthcare that people rely on, resulting in Representative Mace targeting transgender people's ability to access restrooms in federal buildings. This is a cascading reality of material harm for our community on top of the rhetorical and cultural harms that it is bestowing upon us.
I want to play a clip from one of Trump's presidential campaign TV ads for those who didn't see it. This particular one with transphobic messaging that aired, I think it was over 15,000 times.
Kamala supports taxpayer-funded sex changes for prisoners.
Surgery.
For prisoners.
For prisoners. Every transgender inmate in the prison system would have access.
Hell no, I don't want my taxpayer dollars going to that.
Kamala supports transgender sex changes in jail with our money.
Kamala even supports letting biological men compete against our girls in their sports. Kamala is for they, them. President Trump is for you.
I'm Donald J. Trump, and I approve this message.
Kamala is for they, them. Donald Trump is for you. And yesterday, Kamala Harris spoke, and a bunch of the senior members of her staff spoke out on Pod Save America. And a lot of the discussion in that conversation was about how they dealt with these ads. I'm very interested, Chase, as you say, that you are faulting the Democrats and how they're dealing with this, that they are normalizing this. Explain.
Well, so it's not even that they're normalizing it. What they're saying is that the Harris campaign did too much to support trans people, which is a hard pill to swallow since they did nothing. You know, Kamala Harris did not respond to the ads. She did not make any affirmative statements in support of trans people throughout the...
I mean, that's very interesting because apparently they floated the ad first, the Republicans, to see if there would be a response. When there was dead silence, they just went for it.
Yes, so they went for it. And then in the aftermath of the election, you have this postmortem in which you have Democrats, you know, pundits as well as politicians speaking out and saying, well, part of why the Harris campaign lost is because they were too supportive of trans people. But what did they do? Nothing. And so the obvious, you know, takeaway from that is, well, they should have just joined in the attacks. They should have said, yes, it is. Of course we should exclude trans girls from sports. Of course we should deny people in government custody of medical treatment. These are constitutional norms that they are sensationalizing because and playing into people's misunderstanding about trans people and our bodies. And they played on that misinformation and they played on that fear in a campaign that was both about trans people and also about gender more broadly. And what trans people represented in that was the instability of gender roles that were causing so much anxiety. I mean, that's why you saw Vice President-elect Vance talking about the role of postmenopausal women is to care for children. Childless cat ladies, are whatever else he said about that, to demonize people who aren't playing the proper gender roles. It wasn't just about trans people. Trans people were a very specific focus, but this was a broader commentary on an approach to gender that is regressive and dangerous for everyone.
And Chase, in your arguments on the Tennessee case before the Supreme Court, what do you, especially given the large conservative majority on this court, what will you be looking for in terms of the kinds of questions that the justices will ask, or what hope you might have of swaying some of the conservative justices?
Yeah, so, you know, at the end of the day, this really is a simple argument about a law that tells us 10 times over on its face that it's about sex. It says you can't do something if it's inconsistent with your sex. And Tennessee comes in and says, well, that's not really about sex. But that sounds a lot like the arguments that the employers raised in the case of Bostock, where the question was, is it because of sex to fire someone for being transgender. And that was a conservative majority court that said 6-3 that is because of sex. That if you are firing someone because they are transgender, that means you are firing someone assigned male at birth because they identify as a woman. And you are not firing someone assigned female at birth because they identify as a woman. The same is true here. We're making that same argument. We think it is as clear in this context as it was in Bostock. And our hope is that the cultural anxiety about trans people, the demonization of our healthcare, is not going to sway the justices from applying straightforward constitutional principles that have been applied for 50 years.
So you're arguing this case, this is unusual, isn't it, alongside the Biden administration?
So it is not totally unusual. You often have a situation where private parties will bring a case and the United States will intervene, or the United States can weigh in at the Supreme Court as amicus. What is a little bit unusual here is that you really have us as co-equal parties in this case. We are splitting the time with the Solicitor General going first, and I will go after her, and making this argument, both of us, that this is a law that violates the Equal Protection Clause, and that the court, if it is going to faithfully apply its precedents that say that when a government it discriminates based on sex, that it is the government's burden. It's Tennessee's burden to show that the statute that they've passed is constitutional, and they have failed to do that. So we are in it together up until January 20th.
And then what happens? I mean, is there any possibility that this wouldn't happen by January 20th? And then the Trump administration would not be there next year.
So that's absolutely right. We fully expect the Trump administration to switch positions. That is not unusual. Also, there will be other cases in which the administration switches positions. This case was originally brought by the transgender adolescents and their parents who we represent against the Tennessee officials who are charged with enforcing this law that bans their health care. The parties will still be there. There's no reason why the court would in any way be stripped of jurisdiction. So we move forward past January 20th. It's up to the Supreme Court, of course, what happens next.
I want to go back to what's happened in these last few days in Congress. Republican House Speaker Mike Johnson speaking to reporters last week after South Carolina Congress member Nancy Mace introduced this resolution to ban transgender women from using women's restrooms at the Capitol after the election of Delaware Congress member Sarah McBride, the first openly trans Congress member. This is what he said.
Can you talk about the policy that you just mentioned?
Yeah, I'm not sure what more there is to say.
Is it enforceable?
Yeah, like all House policies, it's enforceable. But we have single-sex facilities for a reason, and women deserve women's only spaces. And we're not anti-anyone. We're pro-woman. And I think it's an important policy for us to continue. It's always been, an unwritten policy, but now it's in writing.
So it's an unwritten policy, but now it's in writing. This is the House Speaker, Republican Johnson. And I wanted to ask you about Nancy Mace, this campaign she is on. But it is new. Last year, in 2023, Congressmember Mace, during an interview with CBS News, proclaimed she was, quote, pro-transgender rights and pro-LGBTQ. Now she's putting up little paper signs that say biological above the signs that say women's room.
Yeah, so I think one thing to keep in mind is that the cultural discourse and the popular culture norms shift what happens in law and policy. If you look at the tenor of the conversations in this country, it's shifted so far against trans people that now we have proposed bans on trans people using restrooms in all public buildings. A few years ago, let's say in 2019, the question of trans people in restrooms had really died out. It was something where the proponents of those bans admitted that all of their claims were fabricated, that there was no evidence that there was any harm or violence by allowing trans people to use restrooms that align with who they are, which of course they do. We do all the time. And this idea that there is some unwritten rule in which people are surveilled out of restrooms is just simply not true. It is not enforceable, as we know. But this escalation is a product of the ways in which our public discourse has shifted so dramatically around gender and around trans people.
Are you nervous about next week? You are making history, Chase.
You know, of course I'm nervous. I'm nervous because I am always nervous to do right by my community. And the stakes are so high. This argument is happening in the period of time after the election, before the inauguration, a time when trans people are feeling so vulnerable, a time when, you know, I hear every single day from parents who are asking me if they have to leave the United States. And so that is what I'm carrying with me. You know, I'm nervous for December 4th. I'm nervous for 2025. We don't know what we're up against, but I guess the two things I'll say are that, one, this case is a fight to put a limit on what government officials can do to target trans people across the board, and we are going to fight with everything that we have. And then the other thing I'll say specifically to the trans community, to the people who love trans people, is we have always resisted. We have always taken care of each other, no matter what happens, that is what we'll do.
Chase Strangio, on December 4th, he becomes the first openly transgender attorney to argue a case before the U.S. Supreme Court. Chase is co-director of the American Civil Liberties Union's LGBTQ and HIV Project. We thank you so much for being with us. We hope to talk to you after you make your arguments. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We end today's show in Pakistan, where security forces in Islamabad arrested over 1,000 protesters in a massive crackdown targeting supporters of jailed former Prime Minister Imran Khan during a march on the capital city. At least 6 people died in the protests that began Sunday. Khan's supporters had vowed to stage a sit-in until he was released, but they ended the protest following the security crackdown, which has been described by Khan's supporters is a massacre. Imran Khan has been in prison since August 2023 on what are widely viewed as politically motivated charges. We're joined right now by Asim Sajjad Akhtar. He is Associate Professor of Political Economy at Khed-e-Azam University in Islamabad. He's also affiliated with Pakistan's left-wing Awami Workers Party. Thanks so much for being with us, Professor. If you can just start off by talking about what took place in the last few days. Now, Imran Khan supporters have called off the protests, but the mass protest has taken place and the number of arrests and deaths.
Yes. Thanks, Amy. Well, I mean, some of your viewers will know that this is a long simmering conflict between the PTI, which is Imran Khan's party, and the present government. It has many phases. The most recent sort of big sort of part of this sort of conflict was in February of 24, when in general elections, it's widely sort of understood that Khan's party won the majority of seats, but through various kinds of post-poll rigging, was denied an opportunity to run the government. And this was while Khan was in jail, and he's been in jail now for, I think, 14 months. So this protest, which was called on the 24th of November, was yet another sort of big mass mobilization to demand his release, to demand the release of many other PTI leaders and supporters who have been in and out of prison both before and during this protest, and to basically say, or to demand, in a sense, that this, what the PTI believes, and what I think is reasonable for it to believe, is an illegitimate government, is called to account, and sort of polls are held afresh. And what transpired, as you noted, was a crackdown. Despite the crackdown, mind you, the PTI and its supporters managed to get into the city of Islamabad and all the way to what is called the D-Chowk, which is right close to a series of government buildings, including the parliament. But then late last night, they were pushed back after a lot of, well, initially skirmishes and then serious repression. And right now, we don't actually know the extent of how many people have lost their lives, how many people are injured, because a lot of that is being blanked out by the state media.
And Professor Akhtar, to what do you attribute the mass popularity of Imran Khan, and also this whole question that some of his supporters have raised that he ran afoul of the United States when he was in office?
Well, I mean, Imran Khan is a phenomenon that has many parallels around the world, sort of a self-proclaimed outsider. Who I think has built his popularity around the unpopularity of the so-called liberal centrist parties, or what we would call the liberal establishment, which have over many, many decades now acceded to, for instance, IMF conditionalities, have allowed the military, which of course is Pakistan's most prominent and powerful political force, a free hand. And so, you know, all of these things, and there was a war on terror in Afghanistan and its effects in Pakistan. And Khan sort of pitched himself as an outsider, as an anti-establishment outsider who wanted to change the system. He came to power, as some of your viewers will know, and was in power for the best part of 4 years between 2018 and 2022. And when he fell afoul of the military, initially, his coming to power was largely assisted by the military, but fell afoul of the military in 2022 is when he was booted out. But people like Imran, I think, are in a sense, are able to play to their gallery better when they're out of power. And so the last couple of years, anti-incumbency, with whether it be because of inflation, unemployment, a regime that is pandering to the military at every juncture, I think that has, in a sense, further inflated this support base that Khan enjoys. In a very youthful country, mind you, Pakistan's median age is about 23. And as far as the America thing goes, I don't think there's any conclusive evidence that there was sort of direct meddling in that particular decision for Khan to be booted out in April 2022. That was largely because he fell afoul of the military. But again, as your viewers will know, this is not a country in which the United States needs to intervene at any one juncture. It's had a larger-than-life role partly in sponsoring and propping up Pakistan's military since the Cold War. So the fact that, you know, Khan touches a nerve by speaking about American involvement, I think also speaks to how you can take a particular grain of truth and sort of combine it with mass anti-incumbency to generate a great deal of resentment.
And you mentioned the Pakistani military. Could you talk about the outsized role of the military within Pakistani society? And are there the long-established ties between it and the U.S. military?
That's right. Yes, as I said, this is a story that goes all the way back to the Cold War. Pakistan was widely viewed by the Washington as a anti-communist frontline state. Through the 1950s, 60s, and then most notoriously after 1977, when the so-called jihad was backed by America and sort of, in a sense, operationalized by the Pakistani military. And then again, when that story turned on its head and the old jihadis were now cast as terrorists after 2001, again, it was a military dictatorship of Pervez Musharraf, which was backed heavily by the Bush administrations, and even later on by the Obama administration. So there's a long story, and the Pakistani military has benefited from American support to not only dominate Pakistan's political life, but also largely dominate its economy. And I think what has happened with Khan, because as I noted earlier, Khan actually initially came to power with the support of the military. But what has happened is that this long sort of gestating, simmering sort of undercurrent of sentiment amongst ordinary people about the outsized, as you said, role of the military in Pakistan's political, economic, and social life, I think there it is coming to a head somewhat. Now, time will tell, however, whether Khan and his party are really able and willing to take on the military and sort of the militarized political economy, as I would say, rather than perhaps just seeking a route back into power. But that doesn't excuse, of course, the fact that they have been subject to serious repression over the last couple of years. And I think that has simply reinforced Khan's massive popularity.
So do you see parallels between Imran Khan, who can, you know, as you say, mobilize massive number of people from prison into the streets, even as so many are arrested and a number killed? Do you see parallels between him, who faces a number of corruption charges, and President Trump?
Yeah, as I noted earlier, I mean, he is, as I said, Imran is I think is sort of, in a sense, a symbol of the type of political leader that has emerged, I think, over the last 15, 20 years. Trump is another example. Right next door to us in India is Modi. I mean, there's many such examples, sort of this so-called new outsider who perhaps really isn't as much of an outsider as the narrative would suggest, that builds upon, as I said, the resentment, the disillusionment of the liberal establishment of people with established parties and with the establishment at large. And certainly there's parallels. In fact, Trump and Imran, when they were both in their earlier incarnations in office in 2019, sort of had this very buddy-buddy type engagement when they met. And right now, right after your election on November 5th, there was a lot of PTI online sort of media. Mind you, a lot of the PTI has a great deal of support in the diaspora that sort of played up this notion that maybe a Trump administration would coax the Pakistani military into getting Imran out of power. So there's a lot of parallels. They're not the same thing. They can't be reduced to the same thing. But I do think that it tells us a lot about how the liberal center continues to fail and pave the way for these so-called outsiders to thrive.
Asim Sajjad Akhtar, we thank you so much for being with us, Associate Professor of Political Economy at Kadi Azam University in Islamabad. That does it for our show. Tune in Thursday, Thanksgiving, for a special broadcast with Indigenous scholar Nick Estes and Ta-Nehisi Coates, author of The Message. And on Friday, we'll speak to Namante Nankimo, an Indigenous leader from the Amazon in Ecuador, as well as Palestinian poet Masab Abu-Toha from Gaza. That does it for our show. Special thanks to Mike Berkner, Nate Feltz, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nodura, Sam Alkoff, Tamaria Studio. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Happy holidays.
The Canadian Human Trafficking Hotline is now live nationwide, offering a confidential multilingual service 24/7 to connect human trafficking victims and survivors with social and emergency services. We welcome calls if you have tips, concerns, or questions about human trafficking in your community. If you need help or want to help stop human trafficking, call the hotline now at 1-833-900-1010.
Thank you for listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby Mountain.